You want it?
How about you?
We have the overhead light.
Yeah. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I think we should start the talk so as to give ourselves lots of time for discussion. And I regard it as an honor for me to introduce to you the speaker for this evening. Dr. Diamond is a professor of anthropology and the graduate faculty of the New School for Social Research. He is a senior lecturer in anthropology at Columbia University. He is an editor of Africa Today. He is the author of Nigeria, Model of a Colonial Failure. He is an author and editor of books and monographs about Africa. For 1 year, he did field work in Nigerian Middle Belt region. So it seems to me that we cannot have any person more qualified to lead us in this discussion about Nigeria, historical and military, and the war as it's going on at the moment. And Dr. Diamond will be ready when we get finished to answer some questions if anything is not clear. So it gives me pleasure to hand over to you, Dr. Diamond.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Tonight, instead of going over the detailed history of events since 1966 in Nigeria, I should prefer to place the general situation in Biafra in an historical context. And so I've called this talk Reflections on the African Revolution, the Point of the Biafran Case. Now, it must be stated at once that black Africa remains in bondage. The hopes concerning the possibilities for revolutionary and progressive change have not materialized. There are a number of reasons for this. But first, it is instructive to examine why so many Western intellectuals focused on Africa as the very model of a, quote, emerging, unquote, continent. In my view, these hopes originated in a beneficent form of ethnocentrism and paternalism. Africa, that is, black Africa, was, after all, the most obvious victim of Western imperialism. The slave trade, which engaged all the major European powers, with the exception of Italy, by the way, the arbitrary division of the continent into European fiefdoms, the conflicts for wealth and power in Africa, and the racial question in general, incarnated in black-white relationships in Caliban and Prospero, developed in us the illusion that should Africa become free, the West would somehow be exonerated. Moreover, Africa was the, quote, primitive, unquote, continent par excellence, The contrast with so-called higher European civilization was not only fascinating, but gave Western intellectuals the opportunity to exercise their enlightened judgment about exotic peoples. One is also obliged to note that Africa has served as a center for the most intense concentration of intellectual specialists in underdeveloped areas in recent years. The anthropologists, for example, not to mention tardier fellow disciplinarians, supported by foundations and governments, have turned Africa into a vast conceptual playground. Frequently, they put themselves at the disposal of metropolitan intentions. Finally, with few exceptions, the emerging African leadership has been trained in the West. That is to say, in the forms of Western society, cultivated by us to certain expectations, and their demands have been phrased in political and social contexts that for the most part we understand and of which we approve. It had, for instance, become a cliché that if Nkrumah was a devil, he was at least our devil, as an author writing in Foreign Affairs some years ago put it. All of this adds up to an ethnocentric clearing of the conscience and a paternalistic expectation of others. But the fact is that Africa has not achieved a revolution, and as yet has not generated a revolutionary nucleus, with, as we shall see, the potential exception of beleaguered Biafra. African freedom, where it has been achieved, is merely formal. Macmillan, who was one of the cannier prime ministers of the generation in England, understood this well enough when in his so-called Winds of Change speech, he assured his audience that the political independence of India had worked no great hardship on Great Britain and the Commonwealth, but had on the contrary led to even stronger commercial and sentimental associations. If he was wrong, he was unaware of it. At the very least, he betrayed his intentions, and history has not quite caught up with his assumption. It is necessary to reemphasize that black Africa remains hopelessly dependent upon Europe. The forms of political freedom, as I mentioned, are not only derived from Europe, but the very outline of the emergent states is the outcome, not of any internal thrust of self-unifying peoples themselves, but of European gerrymandering, legitimated by chatter about constitutions, federalism, maturing unity across tribal chasms, and so on. While we celebrated the demise of Frank colonialism and imperialism in Africa, thus deceptively and subtly assuring ourselves of the flexibility and good intentions of Western civilization, we made no significant effort to assist black Africa, whose indigenous cultures we had been instrumental in destroying, to achieve the conditions of a more authentic freedom. Africa, then, is the least revolutionary of the emerging world areas for the following linked external and internal reasons. The external or international reasons may be summarized as follows. One, the blocking of pan-African tendencies by both metropolitan and ex-metropolitan powers. Correlatively, there has been a self-serving refusal to take seriously those notions of African socialism and communalism which projected the possibility of the native quality of traditional societies assuming modern forms through the instrumentality of the most advanced technology. Two, the paucity and opportunism of economic aid, with particular reference to the implicit and explicit promises of the ex-metropolitan powers. Africa remains locked in primary product production and passively subject to the fluctuations of the international market. Three, Africa had become a battleground for the Cold War. Local conditions for growth have been disregarded. The international lines of conflict have been rationalized in terms of the self-interest of the major powers. That is to say, the contrary philosophies of African growth generated in the East and West evade African realities or transform them into mere social weaponry. Four, the trading empires remain pretty much intact. Mining enterprises function basically as they had prior to, quote, independence. The withdrawal of the immediate metropolitan presence worked no great hardship on Europe and had one of the effects, of consolidating and reducing the political dimension of investment risk. The celebration of independence seems, in contrast, almost sentimental. Five, the United States has conveniently left African affairs to the ex-metropolitan powers, who substantially discharge our sense of global purpose and priority. The rationalization being that America has not been a direct imperial force, but American investment in South Africa and Liberia and its North Atlantic economic and military alliance remain the hard core around which these gestures cluster. Six, the United Nations has signaled its impotence above all in Africa, failing to serve as a significant channel for politically neutral aid, failing effectively to support aspirations for even formal freedom in Portuguese and other territories, and intervening militarily in phase with primarily Western interests. Seven, the OAU has emerged as a kind of echo in structure and function of the United Nations, led by politicians who remain trapped between the ex-colonial powers and the African masses. That is to say, the component members of the OAU do not have the intra-African economic and political resources realistically to arm their formal intentions. There is some indication now with the recognition of Biafra by Zambia and Gabon, the Ivory Coast, and Tanzania, that the OAU is beginning to disintegrate with reference to different perspectives on African affairs. Internal reasons, intracontinental reasons for the conditions which I've outlined would be as follows. First, the revolutions in Arabic-speaking states of the North African littoral have been abortive or incomplete for quite complicated reasons that cannot be indicated here. The fact is that the Arabic-speaking states have not served as a nucleus for radiating progressive change in Black Africa. The aims of the Casablanca Group, for example, were never realized. They were inhibited by the antagonism of the metropolitan and ex-metropolitan presence, mediated in part by compradora states such as the post-independence Nigerian Federation. Two, in sub-Saharan Africa, the only industrial power that could have helped consolidate growing progressive forces in South Africa is South Africa, and it's obviously impossible for that state, by internal definition, to perform such a role. Three, metropolitan-trained political elites have little connection with the masses. Four, entrenched bureaucracies and civil servants, along with the intelligentsia and most local business interests, demand immediate prestige and profit, replicating the colonial mold, which is antithetical to both the economic and political dimensions of revolutionary discipline and national growth. Five, there is a lack of, and all too often a lack of concern, with broadly based technical education, which is an aftermath of colonialism. Six, underemployment, unemployment, and migrant labor, swollen, eclectic, slum-ridden cities, pose problems that have not yet found even theoretical solutions. Seven, the collapse of traditional cultures, the instability of transitional forms, and the inadequacy of modern forms have led to a condition which may be designated as one of disintegrative transition. Eight, the power of the military as guardians of colonially formed boundaries and civil order, is a symptom of stasis, that is, of the freezing of state after state by force of arms in a colonial, or rather neo-colonial, status quo. Military control of the type encountered in sub-Saharan Africa also discharges the elementary function of fixing territorial boundaries, although such boundaries may contradict the possibilities of other forms of economic and social union. 9, above all, the peasantries of sub-Saharan black Africa remain quiescent. And this demands a brief general discussion. The problem of the peasant is the revolutionary problem in the world today. It is the basis of the split between the Soviet Union and China, between the countries of the North Atlantic Alliance and most of the rest of the world. A good deal has been written on this matter by the new peasant-oriented revolutionary theorists and activists. You know their names: Franz Fanon, Ho, Mao, Regis Debray, Guevara, Castro, and so on. However, it should be noted that the Russians were aware of the importance of the international peasantry, despite their apocalyptic presupposition about the vanguard role of the industrial working class, but abandoned all practical efforts in the mid-1920s. Their domestic problems with their own largely peasant population and their convulsive attempts at solution, forced collectivization, and so on, were probably the major reasons for their manifest lack of direct concern with peasantries elsewhere. Moreover, the general theory of building socialism in one country took increasing hold in a Western context that hardly offered any alternative, while blocking means of effective political or social communication with the range of peasant types. However, the extent and variety of peasant culture areas would probably have made any sustained effort quixotic. We in the West, particularly in the North Atlantic countries, do not perhaps fully understand the importance of the peasantry. In the West, peasants have been what we can call a self-liquidating social type since the rise of commercialism and industrialism. The proportion of people on the land constantly diminished. In the UK, for example, it's currently about 7%, roughly the same in the United States. And those remaining are, of course, not peasants, but full-fledged farmers. Therefore, the problem of the peasant qua peasant has solved itself, albeit in a capitalistic framework. This is not true elsewhere. That is to say, the processes of urbanization and industrialization, linked to the revolutionary ascendancy of the bourgeoisie in most of Europe, quickly reduced the ranks of the peasantry, and cash-cropping businessmen farmers emerged, while the new technology converted the countryside into an extension of the city. This has not happened, or it's happened to a minor degree, in Africa, in Asia, Latin America, the Near and Middle East. There, the peasantries, in some areas, declining to rural proletariats, have the potential to become restive or are already revolutionary. Their emergence in new rural forms, their relationship to the national institutions and to the urban populations, their actual and potential political weight are central to any projection of the future that we care to entertain on a global scale. Unlike the Western self-liquidating peasantry, the existing peasantries of most of the world will not wither away through social and economic attrition. Their intolerable condition and their self-consciousness will not wait upon the blind processes of urbanization and industrialization, which change the social contours and demography of Europe. The peasants are there. They constitute most of the world's population. They are the poor who are getting poorer, both intranationally and internationally, as the modern world gets richer, its particular internal disparities aside for the moment. The problem of the peasant is multidimensional. On the one hand, he is suspended between primitive subsistence cultivation and a market economy. Even in so-called closed peasant communities within larger national frameworks, the relative absence of marketing connections, as in parts of Bolivia, does not inhibit direct or indirect political or religious ties to any given establishment. But by and large, it is the association with the national market that provides the paradigm for the peasant's linkage to the larger, politically organized national center. That is to say, what has already been said by a number of theorists, a peasantry represents a part culture. Peasants have characteristically functioned and emerged in, quote, archaic civilizations of one type or another. Their voluntary associations with the center have never been strong. As in the pre-revolutionary Russian Mir, there were no tight state controls, but rather tribute was paid in kind or in labor service, granted through the mediation of an internal indirect ruler. Peasants in the emerging world, and in Africa particularly, are not closely wedded to the state in any positive sense. Such peasantries have materialized as a result of the collapse of archaic political societies under the onslaught of colonialism, as in northern Nigeria, or they have developed from the entrapment of primitive peoples in modern markets and new political contexts. The point is that peasants are limited in their revolutionary consistency and movement by their traditional suspicion of external political and economic obligations. This is in the nature of the structural position of the peasant as we examine it historically. At the same time, if the peasant is able to reach a reasonable accommodation with an external authority, the trajectory of that accommodation tends to be self-reinforcing, as, for example, in northern Nigeria, and revolutionary activity may be regarded more of a threat than a hope. Basically, peasants are more exploited than they exploit. This is a psychosocial fact which tends to contradict, or at the very least, make difficult revolutionary initiative as opposed to sporadic rebellion and or scapegoating among them. Peasantries work directly on the land, cultivate for their own subsistence, and are typically at the mercy of the urban markets in the effort to get a decent return on their cash crops. Family members may be, quote, exploited in terms of labor time and access to scarce goods, but intra and interfamilial cooperative arrangements tend to absorb much immediate tension. Given these generally delineated characteristics of the peasantry, it is understandable that their image of revolutionary change is not congruent with that of the urban worker, the middle-class liberal, or the traditional revolutionary theorist. What the peasant wants is adequate land on which he is willing to expand his direct labor, low taxes, minimal national political interference in his network of local associations, and a good return on his produce. The peasant who has been motivated to emerge from a prior condition of intolerable exploitation tends to stop his revolutionary movement at the goals just mentioned. On the other hand, where either scarcity of resources or new abundance leads to the possibility of socioeconomic stratification in a peasantry, the peasant has proven himself to be fully capable of, in the former case, exploiting landless countrymen, and in the latter case, of multiplying his holdings so that he assumes the position of a minor landlord. In any case, the generalization that ordinarily the peasant works directly on the land and does not permanently exploit anyone holds. Moreover, it tends to constitute the peasant's image of himself. We conclude that the peasant must be stimulated to fully coherent and purposeful revolutionary activity by cadres who claim a total view of the emerging social condition for three reasons. One, tenuous identification of the peasantry with the national center. Two, paradoxically, the conservatism of the peasantry when it has made some accommodation to the center. And three, the incomplete character of the peasant's revolutionary aims. In any case, the peasant as a social type, self-liquidating in the West, must become, through the dialectics of revolutionary growth, directed to liquidate himself in the remainder of the emerging world. Rural life, in one form or another, will survive. Agricultural production, of course, remains essential. But the peasant as such becomes eventually a casualty in the total context of progressive change. Communes, state farms, collectives may develop in his place. Many peasants will transiently or otherwise migrate to cities, and consistent revolutionary pressure ultimately destroys the fabric of peasant life, no matter what traditional form is involved. All of these paradoxes and historical accumulations serve as obstacles in furthering national and or socialist revolutions, wherein the majority of peasants remain people remain peasants, and where they cling to a ameliorative view of their own best interests as peasants. Now, it's pertinent to note here that large-scale displacement in the countryside as a result of wars and an alien military presence can trigger peasant resistance, first in a national, then given appropriate leadership through a maze of problems in a socialist form, as in China, Vietnam, and elsewhere. But that requirement is itself a measure of peasant inertia in the total revolutionary process. Of all the world's peasantries, that of sub-Saharan black Africa is the most insulated, the least connected with the developing national frameworks, the least revolutionary, and the least directly affected in the areas which have attained formal independence by foreign military intervention. In this context, let us examine what I have called the Biafran possibility. Politically, economically, and socially, Biafra has the potential to become the first viable state in black Africa and the crystallizing center around which a modern Africa could build itself, both as symbol and to a considerable degree as reality. The reasons lie in the history of the Igbo's relations with the British and with the African neighbors, and above all in the social character and history of the Igbo-speaking peoples themselves. The Igbo-speaking peoples were the basic national revolutionary group in West Africa. It is well known that the British were never able to rule them through the usual colonial techniques. Traditionally, the Igbos in their millions were a highly individualistic people with no strictly political chieftaincies and no politically conceived hierarchical structure. People so organized are difficult to control, since there is no inherent leverage on them, and they retain flexibility of response to what anthropologists euphemistically call acculturation. Among such peoples, for example, the Anagutta of the high plateau of northern Nigeria, this flexibility was shown in efforts to evade any imposition of exterior civil authority, whether colonial or Nigerian. But for the Igbos, given the history of trade and missions among them, another choice was both possible and desirable. Under colonialism, the original social character and independence of the Igbos were transformed into a vast effort at self-modernization. Unlike peoples whose lives are organized in hierarchical structures, they were not in the manipulatable position of having change filtered through to them in ways that were beneficial to an elite of chiefs or permanently entrenched interests. It was typical of the Igbos that they complained bitterly of the absence of technical education and that they had no wish to reproduce themselves in the image of the colonial power. However anachronistically and naively, they tended to look toward the United States, where many of their leaders were educated, as the model of a successful anti-colonial, democratic, and entrepreneurial society. Moreover, the saturation of the Igbo heartland by Irish Catholic installations, including primary schools, was hardly a mechanism for converting Igbo speakers or Easterners generally into Anglophiles. Another factor in the emergence of a coherent Igbo nationality was the fact that Nigeria had become, in effect, an Igbo diaspora. Population pressure on the land in the heart of Igbo territory, along with a general desire for upward mobility, led hundreds of thousands of Igbos to migrate to other parts of the country, primarily to the northern region, which constituted over two-thirds of the territory. Although the superimposed entity known as Nigeria was a British creation, the efforts to achieve internal coherence and the image of a Nigeria unified from the inside were generated primarily by those Igbo migrants. Indeed, prior to the secession of Biafra, Igbo nationality was itself expressed in the drive for a unified Nigeria. To explain the basis for this Igbo concern does not invalidate it, for the Igbos were genuine Nigerian nationalists. They refused to be identified colloquially in any strict ethnic sense, and more often than not would insist on being called Nigerians. The chaotic and tragic history of the years immediately following independence and the political maneuvering that finally resulted in the clear-cut hegemony of the North need not be recapitulated here. The important point is that the Igbos were unable to change the balance of power in Nigeria. Their efforts at coalition and compromise were poorly conceived, hence unavailing. Assuming there was a possibility in the immediate post-independence period to form a coalition with the entire South in order to confront the North with equal power, thus encouraging peaceful change, that possibility was not chosen by the Igbos until it was too late. When the Southern Grand Alliance finally was formed in 1964, the more progressive forces in the West were already decimated. By then, the country was in chaos, and the civilian politicians in the South had been largely discredited. The ultimate consequence, as is well known, were the military coups of January and July 1966. The first, which precipitated General Iranzi into power, conceivably could have succeeded in his stated aim of unifying Nigeria had the younger elements been able to maintain control, and had they in turn been able to reinforce progressive elements in the West while stimulating the anti-feudal and minority peoples in the North represented in the Northern Elements Progressive Union and the United Middle Belt Congress. The Hausa-speaking peasantry would have remained a very serious problem, but it is possible that they would have responded to shifts in local leadership. The unification of Nigeria and a more rational distribution of its resources under the more radical leadership, again largely Igbo, of the first phase of the January 1966 coup might, just might, have made Nigeria politically and economically viable. But when the more establishmentarian Iranzi inherited the coup, the real thrust toward unification faltered. Conservative and reactionary factions were able to regroup, and the result was the counter-coup of July 1966. Colonel Gowon's assumption of power seemed at first, and has since been heralded by certain Ibadan intellectuals, as the symbol of the emergence of minorities holding a so-called balance of power among the major ethnic groups. Gowon, as you know, is a Middle Belter, a Christian, and an Angus. This has not proved to be the case. Even if it had, the paper representation of minorities, for example, in the Middle Belt, would have had no connection with the growth or viability of the state. In any event, it was under Gowon's problematical leadership, clearly influenced by Northern interests, that the massacres of the Igbos intensified to genocide. Though Gowon was not immediately responsible, as head of state, he must bear the ultimate burden of his inability to preserve civil order. It must be noted that Iranzi had undertaken a judicial inquiry into the initial systematic pogrom of May 29, but was deposed at the end of July, coincident with the second series of killings. The proposed inquiry was aborted, and no subsequent judicial action has come to term. At the core of the Biafran venture are the 30,000 Igbo speakers and other Easterners who were slaughtered through October 1966 and the near 2 million refugees who have returned to their homeland and been largely reabsorbed into their extended families. Their moral solidarity, rooted in both terror and a sense of the possible, is absolute. To understand that for them, there is no road back to any entity resembling the former Nigerian Federation, one must recognize the efforts they expended in working toward the United Nigeria, their shocked recognition of the political errors they have made, and the brutalities they have undergone. Their political and social coherence of former days has been transmuted into an authentically modern nationality. This consciousness of kind is evident through all ranks and classes of the population, and that includes the peasantry, which comprise still the great majority of Igbos. Under intolerable external pressure, heightening as this war persists, a national peasantry with an Igbo nucleus has been forged in Biafra, a peasantry responsive to the national leadership and the situation in the cities. Although new in certain respects, the national consciousness was foreshadowed in the structure of the Igbo Improvement Unions that existed wherever the Igbos settled in Nigeria. In a sense, these unions were the national possibility in microcosm. Most, if not all, Igbos in a given area would belong to one of them. The constituency was typically composed of rich merchants, houseboys, policemen, petty traders, professionals, and so on. But as members of the Improvement Union, they were equally Igbo together, perpetuating in a different form the aboriginal social character of the people. In other words, the educational, mutual aid, and latently political functions of these unions overrode distinctions of class and status. National identity had priority over other interests. This is not to say that other interests were obliterated. It was rather a matter of discharging immediate needs by the most historically feasible means. The unions also enabled Igbos to maintain connections with their areas of origin, both rural and urban. This meant that the improvement unions outside Igbo land implicitly served as the national nucleus for the Igbos while explicitly supporting the idea of a unified Nigeria. When the latter possibility was reduced through political misjudgment on the part of the Igbos themselves and finally obliterated by their being victimized, the nationality in microcosm, which the unions symbolized, they represented, was turned inward, and the result was the authentically national emergence of Biafra. In historical sequence, then, the aboriginal egalitarianism, individuality, and self-identification of the Igbo-speaking peoples was symbolically expressed in the unions, which today help us understand the basis and depth of the Biafran nationality. Those who emphasize the existence of class distinctions among Igbos in Biafra, Ojukwu, for example, stems from one of the richest families in Nigeria, underestimate the primary importance of national identification. There may be struggles between conflicting social and economic interests in the former eastern region of Nigeria, but from now on, they will occur within the arena of nationality. This has happened elsewhere in the world, and abstract analyses of tensions within Biafra do not come to grips with the dynamics of the situation. It does not necessarily follow, in terms of absolute logic, that Igbo nationality must inevitably coincide with formal political sovereignty, that is, statehood. It is conceivable that should negotiations take place without a priori conditions, a point which is now being disputed, and should sufficient guarantees be given for the safety of the peoples of the former eastern region, some kind of confederal arrangement could be worked out that would maintain the nominal existence of the old Nigeria. What is entirely clear is that the main center of development in Nigeria will remain in the east because of its coherent nationality, its mobile, individualistic, and industrious people, and its economic resources. Indeed, it is impossible to imagine a viable Nigeria without the East. With this in mind, it is possible to anticipate international arrangements between a politically independent Biafra, Nigeria at large, and West Africa as a whole, in which Biafra could assume the generative but not dominating role that had been envisaged for Ghana. The pre-war Nigerian nationality was always largely nominal, what substance it had having been attributable mainly to the Igbos' self-identification as Nigerians. Today, the Igbos no longer serve as pan-Nigerian catalysts, though by an ironic twist, the Igbos as victims and enemies continue serving as a basis for Nigerian identity. By turning the Igbos into scapegoats and by attacking the Igbos, those who now claim to be Nigerian Unitarians are able to generate a mechanical sense of identity. But no area outside the East has there emerged an authentic modern nationality rooted in Aboriginal organization and transitional and modern political and social forms. The Hausa-speaking peasantry was subordinate prior to colonialism and remained so. The minority peoples of the Middle Belt were for the most part, quote, tribal. That is, they concentrated on subsistence production and had no associations that fulfilled the imperatives of modern development. The Yoruba-speaking peoples maintained a hierarchical structure. They were deeply split aboriginally, and their divisions have been dramatically evident in the post-colonial period. I should add as a footnote that the contemporary split that is since independence among Yoruba-speaking peoples was in part the result of manipulation between the NCNC and the NPC at the center, and I should be glad to talk about that if anybody is interested. So it is the Igbos, now the pariahs of Nigeria, who are helping the others to construct the fiction of their own national identity. But the aggressor's sense of unity is almost always a fiction. It is the victim who learns the real name of the game. The federal government attacked the Igbos, those premature Nigerian Unitarians, in the name of unity, and so generated an illusory strength, the strength of the aggressor who resents the faith that was invented by the victim and imposed on the others. The Igbos are attacked because they now must oppose what they in large part originated, and thus they are charged with betraying the adopted cause of the others. There is more than a suggestion of the historical psychology of anti-Semitism here. In the foregoing sense, the Igbos are certainly the Jews of Nigeria, an ethnic parallel that applies in other ways as well. Having considered themselves citizens of the world, the Igbos had nurtured the idea of common citizenship with all the people among whom they lived. To inquire into the precise identity of an Igbo was to insult his sense of fraternity with other Africans in Nigeria. Being an Igbo was a private affair, perhaps a source of pride, but the public image was Nigerian. Obviously, this is no longer true. The Igbos have been driven home. They have discovered through catastrophe that their public definition is Igbo. But because Biafra encompasses other ethnic groups, the Igbos call themselves Biafrans as a sign of their refusal to be forced back into a particularistic identity which they know has no relevance in the modern world. The position of the ethnic minorities in Biafra is not comparable, of course, to that which the Igbos sustained in northern Nigeria, nor even of Arabs in Israel prior to the recent war. There is every intention further to create a Biafran nationality for which the Igbos serve as a nucleus and for which they are willing to surrender any remaining parochialism. As one reflects on the confrontation between the Igbo-speaking peoples, other Easterners, and the northern establishment, one gains a sense of inevitable progression across a cultural interface. For the basic clash in Nigeria has very deep cultural roots. The Igbos are egalitarian in ethics, behavior, and organization. They modernized themselves. Education is almost a fetish with them. They are essentially Christian in faith, though secular in temperament, and they hold to the idea of individual conscience and responsibility. They are upwardly mobile, eagerly becoming traders, civil servants, technicians, dispensers of modern ideas, leaders in social action and social amelioration. They transformed native structures into the idea of Nigeria as a modern polity. A similar characterization of the cultural style of the North yields a series of polar oppositions. Northern society is hierarchically structured, and at least in the upper echelons, conservatively Islamic. Paradise awaits the true believer, and fatalism blunts social action in depth. The goal, traditionally, is the protection of the received structure. Islam embraces the principle of collective responsibility, as Trimmingham and others have pointed out, in which any person stands for his group, class, or family. Viewed from the North, Nigeria was conceived as a theocracy. The inevitably resulting Igbo Northern opposition was further sharpened by the economic threat the Igbos posed to the routinely corrupt and nepotic Northern hierarchy. This profound cultural antipathy, which the British may have understood, but which they did not accommodate in their policy of imposing Nigerian unity, held the seeds of the tragedy. One must reluctantly point out that historically, the conservative Islamic hierarchies, and we are not talking about modern Islam, have dealt with strangers in their midst by holding them in tribute as a subject population, or alternatively, by converting them. One hears that the few converted Igbos in the North, for example, have not been molested. But if neither course is possible, and if the alien population is an implicit threat to the social basis of the hierarchy, then it must be obliterated. This element in the pogroms cannot be overlooked. No matter what other path could have been followed in Nigeria, there was the inescapable existence of a most fundamental cultural conflict between Igbo speakers and the Northern establishment. The confrontation, as it turned out, was merely postponed by the short-lived coalition of the respective political arms of the cultures involved. All of this is now understood by the Igbos themselves. I believe the essential key to a solution of the present impasse is to extend the protection of political sovereignty to all Easterners. The best statement of this that I've seen is in the Tanzanian formal declaration of recognition. It is first of all a question of humanity. But beyond that is the question I raised in the beginning, the question of creating an autonomous and viable black Africa from a possibility such as that offered by Biafra, both as West African catalyst and Pan-African symbol. Biafran nationality, with appropriate political boundaries and fruitful Pan-African associations, could prove to be Africa's last real chance in the foreseeable future. I should like to conclude by saying one word about tribalism, so-called, to reemphasize what we confront in Biafra is the consolidation of a modern people. Ironically, the war itself may set a similar process in motion in the more parochial areas of the Federation. In any event, the basic dynamics of the Nigerian situation have never been predominantly tribal. The Hausa, Fulani, Yoruba, Igbo process of political conflict and accommodation before, during, and following formal independence is a function of the class, national, and neo-colonial nature of the struggle in Nigeria, of the African struggle at large. Recourse to the explanatory principle, quote, tribalism, is a Western reification which blocks our view of African reality and deflects our attention from our own responsibility. Thank you.